Hi, welcome to the Subway ad for $2.99 subs. How would you like it?
I'll take Drill Sergeant, please.
You got it.
All right, now listen up. I want each and every one of you to drop and give me a 6-inch meatball marinara, cold cut combo, veggie delight, or Black Forest ham on your choice of bread with any veggies you want for just $2.99 each.
Sir, yes, sir!
Subway! Make it what you want at participating restaurants. Additional charge for extras plus applicable tax. No additional discounts or coupons may be applied.
This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
On January 23, 1963, President Richard Nixon ordered a ceasefire in Vietnam. The Boston Strangler was sentenced to life in January. India became a republic. In 1981, Tehran freed the American hostages held for 444 days. George Orwell died on January 21, 1950. You're listening to Hari Anin Alam Sejarah Dunia. I am Uma Paganam Pike Pagan, and today I'm going to be telling you four stories surrounding four remarkable events that took place in January. The birth of Viktor Lustig, the siege of Leningrad, and the tragic end of the space shuttle Challenger. But first, did you know that on the 28th of January 1807, London became the first city in the world to be lit by gaslights?
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And the earth was without form and void. And darkness was upon the face of the deep. And the Spirit of God moved upon the face of the waters. And God said, "Let there be light." And there was light.
In the 18th century, London was a dark city, and it was a brave walker who ventured out without servants to lead the way with a lamp in one hand and a cudgel in the other. Those who could not afford to keep servants would pay a few coins to a link boy, named after their links or torch wicks. These wild street urchins, the sons of harlots and thieves, would walk ahead carrying a stick with a rag dipped in tar and set alight. Some were cat pursers, leading their customers into courts and alleyways and stealing what they could in the darkness. Some were preys themselves, vulnerable to the attentions of unscrupulous men who would have their way with the boys for a few more farthings. Those who couldn't afford to be guided in the dark took their chances or rushed home before sunset. Then, in 1807, an extraordinary conjuring trick was performed on Pall Mall. To celebrate the birthday of King George III, Frederick Windsor, an engineer, lit the most spectacular of candles. To gasping crowds, he instantly illuminated a line of gas lamps. Each one was fed with gas pipes made from the barrels of old musket guns, and all Windsor had to do was apply a single spark to light up the whole street. The mall was almost impassable with spectators until after midnight. Many panicked about the newfangled technology. Explosions were alarmingly common in the early days, but for the first time in its history, London was safe, relatively speaking, to walk at night. The Victorian periodical, the Westminster Review, wrote that the introduction of gas lamps had done more to eliminate immorality and criminality on the streets than any number of church sermons. Over the following decades, thousands of gas lamps went up across London, and it would stay that way until the advent of electricity.
While fashions came and went, and the pace of life grew quicker and brighter, they still shed their soft and sympathetic light. Their panes of glass were a window on a vanished world. But progress has no place for sentimentality. The old gas mantle can't compete with the new sodium lamp, whose illumination can be up to 20 times as great. One man whose feet are firmly planted in the past is Harry Brightwell, who's been lighting London's gas lamps for over 40 years. In fact, he's the last real lamplighter in the capital, the only one to use the traditional flame-tipped pole. Every night he does his rounds of the 102 lights in the temple, one of the last gas-lit strongholds of the age of Queen Victoria. Central London's remaining gas lamps are being replaced at the rate of 400 a year. In 5 years' time, this mellow, friendly light will be no more than the memories it conjures up.
At the doorstep of Kensington Palace lies one of the most magical walks in all of London. The long avenue, lined with embassies and the mansions of billionaires, is lit only by gas lamps. Their glass heads are a constellation of stars. It is one of the rare places in the city where a walker can imagine what it might have once been like to walk that capital at night. These glowing sentry posts are among the last Victorian gas lamps in London. In a city blazing with electricity, with office lights left on all night, these 19th century survivors offer a glimpse of the city as it was when Charles Dickens wrote his dark and smog-filled novels. There are 1,500 gas lamps left in London. The group English Heritage decided to preserve them after almost all the others were replaced by electric lamps. These look almost exactly the same as when they were first installed 200 years ago. They're just a little taller to accommodate modern traffic. There are 1,500 gas lamps left in London, and of the 30,000 workers that British Gas employs, five of them still carry a torch that has been burning for two centuries. They are the lamplighters, tending to gas lamps that still line the streets in some of London's oldest neighbourhoods and parks. As these lamplighters set out on their nightly rounds, they don't actually carry torches and they don't wear top hats and waistcoats. In their blue and grey jackets with the British Gas logo, they look like 21st century utility workers. In these parts of London, the gas lamps glow with a soft, parchment-coloured light. The light given off by an electric lamp, by contrast, is harsh and fierce and white. But unlike the soulless, identical electric lights, these gas lamps are temperamental. Their mechanisms have to be wound and checked, the glass polished and the mantles replaced. These are teardrop-shaped elements which look from the ground like bulbs, but from the top of a lamplighter's ladder they are revealed to be tiny, bell-shaped silk casings coated in lime oxide which become white-hot to give their lamps their glow.
Something that London can bury beneath its clatter. Only a few sad sentimentalists cherish London pride, cherish the sight even of old street lamps made not for a functional age, but for a time when fairy lights were thought of. Just look at these and merge them yourself with parasols and hansom cabs. Slowly, the dim-lit past of London is being replaced. Slowly they're taking away those graceful relics of Victorian frippery. But are they gone forever? Will they never be seen again? Oh yes, the strength of sentimentalists is strength indeed.
In 1939, the journalist H.V. Morton wrote a book called The Ghosts of London, which he lamented the loss of the lamplighters who were once seen on every street at dusk. There were 412 of them. Today, there are just five left, and it is thanks to them that this remarkable part of London's history has endured, and that in the few squares and parks and alleyways, it is still possible to walk the glowing streets which long before electric pollution, Dickens himself would have walked. Coming up, I fast forward to the tail end of the 19th century, to the year 1890, to the birth of one Victor Lustig, a man who would grow up to be one of the greatest con artists in history. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
George Gershwin, star of an age of great songwriters, refines the jungle rhythms of jazz for the unrefined, and band leader Paul Whiteman interprets them for those hell-bent on going places and doing things. restraint, manners, morals, bush war, nurse, banana oil. The shell shock of war and the cynicism that followed changes all that. This is a new day. All gods are dead, all wars fought, and all faiths shaken, according to Scott Fitzgerald. But Edna St. Vincent Millay hits the nail on the head. My candle burns at both ends. It will not last the night. But ah, my foes, and oh, my friends, it gives a lovely light. So let's jazz it up. Let's neck. Let's pet. Maybe we'll even get glotto. Ain't we got fun?
On a Sunday night in May 1935, Victor Lustig was strolling down Broadway on New York's Upper West Side when Secret Service agents swooped in. Surrounded, Lustig smiled and calmly handed over his suitcase. Smooth was how one of the agents described him, noting a livid scar on his left cheekbone and dark, burning eyes. After chasing him for years, they'd gotten a close-up view of the man known as the Count, a nickname he'd earned for his suave and worldly demeanor. Under questioning, he was serene and poised. Agents expected the suitcase to contain freshly printed banknotes from various Federal Reserve series, or perhaps other tools of Lustig's million-dollar counterfeiting trade. But all they found were expensive clothes. At last, they pulled a wallet from his coat and found a key. They tried to get Lustig to say what it was for, but the Count shrugged and shook his head. The key eventually led agents to the Times Square subway station, where it opened a dusty locker, and inside it, agents found $51,000 in counterfeit bills and the plates from which they had been printed.
Have you seen the well-to-do upon Lenox Avenue? On that famous thoroughfare, with their noses in the air, high hats and colored collars, white spats and $15, spending every dime for a wonderful time.
You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia. I'm Uma Pagan Ampake Pagan, and today I'm going to tell you the story of the man who sold the Eiffel Tower.
By April 1st, 1888, the 300-meter Tower of Paris was an eruption of iron lifting skyward and carrying with it the spirit of France. And finally, the general public, it seemed, was falling in love. What had begun as the skeletal suggestion of form was now exhibiting grand, flowing design. The graceful rise of the legs, the arcing, decorative additions contrasting with the stern regimen of exposed bolts. Here was a work of art that spoke to an aggressive world preparing for dramatic change.
Victor Lustig was born on the 4th of January, 1890, in what is now the Czech Republic. As a young man, he studied languages. He studied people, their habits, mannerisms, and especially their weaknesses. When he decided to set out to see the world, he thought, where better to make money than aboard ocean liners packed with wealthy travelers? Charming and poised at a young age, Lustig spent time making small talk with successful businessmen and sizing up potential marks. Eventually, talk turned to the source of the Austrians' wealth, and reluctantly he would reveal in the utmost confidence that he had been using a money box. Eventually, he would agree to show the contraption privately. He just happened to be traveling with it. It resembled a steamer truck, crafted of mahogany but fitted with sophisticated-looking printing machinery within. Lustig would demonstrate the money box by inserting an authentic $100 bill, and after a few hours of chemical processing, he'd extract two seemingly authentic $100 bills. He had no trouble passing them aboard the ship, and it wasn't long before his wealthy new friends would inquire as to how they too might be able to come into possession of a money box. Reluctantly again, the Count would consider parting with it if the price was right, and it wasn't uncommon for several potential buyers to bid against one another over several days at sea. Lustig was, if nothing else, patient and cautious. He would usually end up parting at the end of the voyages with a device for the sum of $10,000, sometimes two and three times that amount. He would pack the machine with several $100 bills, and after any last-minute suspicions had been allayed through successful test runs, the Count himself would disappear. By 1925, however, Victor Lustig had set his sights on grander things. After he arrived in Paris, he read a newspaper story about the rusting Eiffel Tower and the high cost of its maintenance and repairs. Parisians were divided in their opinion of the structure, built in 1889 for the Paris Exposition and already a decade past its projected lifespan. Many felt the unsightly tower should be taken down.
The Paris arts community saw the tower as a rude, industrial imposition on the city's beauty. Dozens of French writers and painters attacked the tower in a public declaration. "I feel Paris is threatened," claimed one artist, "by this positively tragic lampstand issuing from her stomach."
Lustig devised a plan that would make him a legend in the history of con men. He researched the largest metal scrap dealers in Paris. Then he sent out letters on fake stationery claiming to be the deputy director of the Minister of Post and Telegraph and requesting meetings that, he told them, might prove lucrative. In exchange for such meetings, he demanded absolute discretion. So he took a room at the Hotel de Crillon, one of the city's most upscale hotels, where he conducted meetings with the scrap dealers, telling them that a decision had been made to take bids for the right to demolish the tower and take possession of 7,000 tons of metal. Lustig rented limousines and gave tours of the tower, all to discern which dealer would make the ideal mark. André Poisson was fairly new to the city, and Lustig quickly decided to focus on him. When Poisson began peppering him with questions, Lustig baited his lure. As a public official, he said he didn't earn much money, and finding a buyer for the Eiffel Tower was a very big decision. Poisson bit. He'd been in Paris long enough to know what Lustig was getting at. The bureaucrat must be legitimate. Who else would dare seek a bribe? Poisson would pay the phony deputy director $20,000 in cash, plus an additional $50,000 if Lustig could see to it that his was the winning bid. Lustig secured the $70,000, and in less than an hour, he was on his way back to Austria. He waited for the story to break, with possibly a description and sketch of himself, but it never did. Poisson, fearful of the embarrassment such a disclosure would bring upon him, chose not to report Lustig's scam.
Count Victor Lustig actually had an amazing run-in with Al Capone. So they were both in Chicago in the 20s, and Lustig went to see Al Capone, and he said, "Mr. Capone, I need to borrow $50,000 to finance a scam, and I'll be happy to pay you back double that money 2 months from today." And Capone said, "You know, no funny business, 2 months from today, exactly." But Lustig, who was a very smart guy, when he got the $50,000 for Capone, just came home, kept it in his living room for 2 months. He didn't try to set up a con, he didn't invest it in anything. All he wanted was to gain Capone's confidence, and 2 months to the day, he came back to Capone's office. And he said, "Mr. Capone, I'm really sorry to tell you this," and he could see Capone starting to tense up. "I'm really sorry, but there was a horrible disaster, Mr. Capone, and so I'm returning your $50,000, but I wasn't able to make you any profit." And Capone, you know, who's been through many things, has never seen someone return his money and is completely relieved. And he said, "Well, Mr. Lustig, that's a fascinating story, and I understand and I appreciate your honesty. And here's $5,000 for your trouble."
On August 31, 1949, the New York Times reported that Emil Lustig, the brother of Victor Lustig, had told a judge in Camden, New Jersey, that the infamous Count had died at Alcatraz 2 years before. It was most fitting. Victor Lustig, one of the most outrageously colorful con men in history, was able to pass from this earth without attracting any attention whatsoever. After this, a story from the siege of Leningrad. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. It was horrific. The Siege of Leningrad began on September 8, 1941, when German troops completed the encirclement of the city and ended on 27 January 1944. In the almost 2.5 years, it cost the lives of an estimated 1 million city residents.
Leningrad stands out as a symbol of the courage and persistence of the Russian people. For days, weeks, months, years, Leningrad resisted capture by Hitler's forces. In the aching cold of winter, with nothing to eat, no way to keep warm, hundreds of thousands of Leningraders perished from starvation or simply froze to death. Still, they fought on. During the terrifying siege, which the Russians call the 900 days, Nazi troops encircled the city and cut off all communications. But Leningrad would not surrender.
You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia. I'm Uma Pagan, I'm PK Pagan, and I'm about to tell you a story of heroism and humanity that took place during one of the most brutal and barbaric sieges in World War II history. The story of the Shostakovich Seventh Symphony is one of the most astonishing in the history of music. In the summer of 1942, Leningrad was starving. It had been under siege and bombardment by German forces for nearly a year, and yet an orchestra managed to perform a new symphony by the composer Dmitri Shostakovich and broadcast it across the city.
During the Great Terror, the composer Dmitri Shostakovich, like everyone else, walked a tightrope. A native of Leningrad, he was a prodigy of the city's celebrated conservatory. And while still a teenager, he won international fame with his first symphony and established his claim to be the leading composer of the Soviet era. But status brought no immunity from Stalin's terror. Far more helpful to Shostakovich was the Song of the Counterplan, which he'd written for a hit movie in 1932 and which was said to be one of Stalin's favourites. In Stalin's Russia, that kind of popularity could save your life.
When conductor Karl Eliasberg received instructions to rehearse Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, he had a problem. After a performance the previous December of Tchaikovsky's 1812 overture, which depicts Russia's victory over Napoleon's invading army, the only remaining orchestra in the city, the Leningrad Radio Orchestra, had shut down. A note in the ensemble's log records, and I quote, "Rehearsal did not take place. Srabian is dead. Petrov is sick. Borishev is dead. Orchestra not working." End quote.
Far away from the suffering city, Shostakovich struggled to complete the Seventh Symphony. Evacuated to Moscow, he and his family soon had to flee from there too, as the Germans continued their inexorable advance. Along with thousands of other refugees, they travelled by train hundreds of miles east. After a chaotic 7-day journey, during which the score of the Seventh was nearly lost forever, they ended up in Koivishev, the Soviet Union's provisional wartime capital, on the banks of the Volga River. It was in this overcrowded city of refugees, in cramped, noisy accommodation, that Shostakovich tried to find a fitting resolution to his epic work. A musical victory that he hoped would inspire the ultimate military victory.
So it was no surprise that when Eliasberg recalled his musicians for rehearsal, only 15 turned up. The first rehearsal broke up after just 15 minutes, as the small band of survivors had so little energy. The orchestra was consisting of players who were victims of bombings and hunger and starvation, and they were barely able to hold their instruments to play. One trumpeter offered a profound apology after failing to produce a single note. Reinforcements were needed. The Soviet authorities sent an order down the battle lines, ordering any musician to report for rehearsal. Men came from military camps and would rehearse between assignments. The conductor, Karl Eliasberg, imposed strict discipline to get his players into shape. Wind players, in particular, might get lightheaded or keel over when they played, but he would cut the bread ration of any players who performed badly or arrived late for a rehearsal, even if they had been delayed burying a dead family member.
But how do you write out musically victory when victory is not in sight? Because quite a lot of people thought at this time the war was lost. It was such a huge, devastating moment. So there wasn't even a chink of light at the end of the tunnel. And the torment is in that finale. I think the torment of him trying to write this finale, but also the torment the people are going on the way this victory. Somehow this, again, it coincides, you know, the compositional process coincides with the war.
The instrumentalists worked together 6 days a week, and piece by piece the symphony came together. The day of the performance, 9th August 1942, arrived with the orchestra having played it all the way through only once, at a dress rehearsal 3 days earlier. Just before, the Soviet army did a vicious bombardment of the German army lines in order to silence the German guns so the concert could take place without being interrupted. Loudspeakers were set up throughout the city to relay the performance not only to the population, but to the German troops as well. The orchestra was starving, but they were all dressed up in bow ties. The first full performance in Leningrad, given in August 1942 by a half-starved orchestra, is best symbolized by the drummer Zaudat Iodrov, who had literally been rescued from the dead. Iodrov was thought already to be a corpse, but the desperate conductor Karl Eliasberg went to the morgue to make sure and discovered the supposed cadaver moving and breathing. Iodrov took arguably the most demanding role in the symphony, playing the side drum that beats the relentless rhythm of war at the heart of the first movement. For those receiving the music, what they heard was the tragedy and suffering of their own experiences transmuted into a symphonic epic. What they saw was their desperate hopes and their individual courage and collective resistance in the final, overwhelmingly intense sounds of longed-for victory. Coming up, it's the 28th of January 1986, and the space shuttle Challenger explodes in mid-flight, shortly after its launch from Cape Canaveral, Florida, claiming the lives of 7 astronauts. You're listening to Hari Nidalam Sajara Dunia, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. When the Space Shuttle Challenger lifted off on January 28, 1986, spaceflight was supposed to be safe. NASA had spent 25 years sending Americans into space at an average pace of about twice a year. That aura of safety was part of the reason why Christa McAuliffe, a teacher from New Hampshire, was on board, the first non-astronaut to have that privilege. It was also part of the reason why what happened to the Challenger on that day was so shocking.
We have main engine start, 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. liftoff of the 25th Space Shuttle mission, and it has cleared the tower.
Roger, Challenger. Good roll program confirmed. Challenger now heading downrange. Engines beginning throttling down now at 94%. Normal throttles for most of the flight, 104%. We'll throttle down to 65% shortly.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
Challenger, go at throttle up.
1 minute, 15 seconds. Velocity, 2,900 feet per second. Altitude, 9 nautical miles. Downrange distance, 7 nautical miles. Dynamics officer indicate that the vehicle apparently exploded and that impact in the water. This is Mission Control Houston. We have no additional word at this time.
As the world watched on live television, McAuliffe and six astronauts had disappeared in an orange and white fireball 9 miles above the Atlantic Ocean. So too had the Space Shuttle Challenger, the trusted $1.2 billion workhorse on which they had been riding.
We mourn seven heroes. Michael Smith, Dick Scobie, Judith Resnick, Ronald McNair, Ellison Onizuka, Gregory Jarvis, and Krista McAuliffe. We mourn their loss as a nation together. The families of the seven, we cannot bear as you do the full impact of this tragedy. But we feel the loss, and we're thinking about you so very much. Your loved ones were daring and brave, and they had that special grace, that special spirit that says, give me a challenge and I'll meet it with joy. They had a hunger to explore the universe and discover its truths. They wished to serve, and they did. They served all of us.
You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia. I'm Uma Paganampike Pagan, and for our final story today, I'm going to tell you about how the physicist Richard Feynman would eventually explain what happened to the Space Shuttle Challenger. The images are indelible for those of us who saw them. Those contrails in the sky billowing out like leafy stems from a flower. The face of Grace Corrigan peering skyward, etched in confusion, shaded by her hand, her daughter, Krista McAuliffe, NASA's first teacher in space, was aboard the Space Shuttle Challenger with six other astronauts. She scoured the Florida sky for the spacecraft but saw only smoke and debris. All seven astronauts aboard died. Commander Francis Scobie, Pilot Michael Smith, Mission Specialist Ellison Onizuka, Mission Specialist Judith Resnick, Mission Specialist Ronald McNair, Payload Specialist Gregory Jarvis, and McAuliffe.
There's a coincidence today. On this day, 390 years ago, the great explorer Sir Francis Drake died aboard ship off the coast of Panama. In his lifetime, the great frontiers were the oceans, and a historian later said he lived by the sea, died on it, and was buried in it. Well, today, we can say of the Challenger crew, their dedication was, like Drake's, complete. The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us for the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them, this morning, as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye, and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
So what went wrong? The Challenger Accident Investigation Board was made up of 13 members, including William P. Rogers, Neil Armstrong, Richard Feynman, Donald Cutina, Sally Ride, and Charles Yeager. Of all those on the commission, Richard Feynman was the only member who enjoyed complete freedom from political pressure. Feynman was a famous physicist and Nobel Prize laureate with a distinct distaste for corruption and red tape. Although he had little demonstrated knowledge of or interest in space, his motivation to uncover the truth about Challenger was palpable. Ignoring requests to remain in close proximity to the team in Washington, Feynman boarded a plane and visited unannounced to the facilities of Morton Thiokol, the firm responsible for manufacturing the shuttle's booster rockets. He interviewed Thiokol employees wherever he could, the lunchroom, the hallway, the manufacturing floor, and quickly realized the great fracture in communication between the engineers, manufacturers, and managers, both at Morton Thiokol and NASA. As the investigation continued, he discovered a disturbing lack of technical understanding in some of NASA's highest-ranking managers. The dots became increasingly easier to connect. Recklessness and oversight were directly linked to the tragic accident, and Feynman would later demonstrate on national television just how much. During one of the commission's closed meetings, Lawrence Molloy, the project manager at NASA for solid rocket boosters, told the commission members O-rings were required to operate across a wide range of temperatures, but he could not provide detailed test data. The next day, he briefed the commission on the mechanics of the O-ring using jargon, charts, and diagrams. The question, however, still burned. What happens to O-rings exposed to extreme temperature changes?
Before the event, from information that was available and understanding that was available, was it fully appreciated everywhere that this seal would become unsatisfactory at some temperature? And was there some sort of a suggestion of a temperature at which the SRB, I guess you call it, shouldn't be run?
Yes, sir. There was a suggestion of that. To answer the first question, given the configuration that we ran, that the seal would function at that temperature. That was the final judgment.
Frustrated, Richard Feynman devised a plan.
NASA officials discounted the possible effect of cold weather on the resiliency of the rubber O-ring on launch day, but Commission member Richard Feynman, after examining the O-ring, had a surprise.
During the Commission's next televised hearing, he submerged a small O-ring into a cup of ice water. A professor of physics at Caltech, he was practiced in the art of simplifying complex theoretical concepts. When he withdrew the O-ring, he applied pressure to it using a C-clamp and then held it up for the NASA officials and the national viewing audience to see. The O-ring was stiff.
Oh, I took the stuff that I got out of your seal and I put it in ice water. And I discovered that when you put some pressure on it for a while and then undo it, it maintains. It doesn't stretch back, it stays the same dimension. In other words, for a few seconds at least, and more seconds than that, there's no resilience in this particular material when it's at a temperature of 32 degrees. I believe that has some significance for our problem.
In less than 1 minute, Richard Feynman had demonstrated the cause of the Challenger disaster. His overly simple demonstration tore apart all of NASA's attempts to conceal the truth behind complex language. Feynman, having collected a fair share of insights and perspectives on his own, submitted his personal observations for inclusion with the more formal report. In it, he exposed his reason to believe NASA's calculations and logic were flawed. He writes that NASA suffered from an almost incredible lack of communication and encouraged ordinary citizens to fly in such a dangerous machine as the shuttle.
Let us make recommendations to ensure that officials deal in a world of reality. They must live in reality in comparing the cost and utility of the shuttle to other methods of entering space.
In his final sentences, Richard Feynman states, "For a successful technology,
reality must take precedence over public relations. For nature cannot be fooled."
We will never forget them, or the last time we saw them, this morning as they prepared for their journey and waved goodbye and slipped the surly bonds of Earth to touch the face of God.
You've been listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia, the evening edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.
Now's the time to find your color, your paint, and everything to get started during red, white, and blue savings at the Home Depot. Transforming your room is easier than ever. With the best deals online and in-store, you can confidently select your color and the tools for your next paint project. Get a colorful new experience in the right paint for the right price. Save $10 on 1 gallon and $40 off 3 and 5 gallons for a limited time only at the Home Depot. More saving, more doing. Limit 25 gallons per household. See store for details.